This week on Making Contact.
And for the leaders, we want to say, you took the world for a ride with Kyoto. You created a system to reward the polluters. $30 billion the polluters have walked away with carbon trading.
The climate talks at Copenhagen closed in 2009, with no binding agreements or timetables for curbing greenhouse gas emissions. Only pledges were made to avoid dangerous climate change. On this edition, we hear from climate justice activists who went to Copenhagen. They say, we need a system change, not climate change. I'm Tina Rubio, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, battle ideas, and important information. Thousands of members of civil society came to voice a way forward at last December's climate talks in Copenhagen. But many weren't there to talk cap and trade or making a marketplace of airspace.
The time is long past for big capital to make more money. The earth must call the shots. The earth will write the rules.
Among them was ecology activist and author Vandana Shiva. She talked about fundamental lifestyle shifts.
So while we defend a legally binding treaty and we defend the countries that insist on a legally binding treaty, we also know there are things we can do. I do ecological farming. I protect seeds and biodiversity. I've written a book on what we have achieved. 40% of the solution to climate change lies in organic ecological farming in the hands of small farmers. That is also a 100% solution to hunger and poverty. And when it comes to food and farming, we can decide what we eat, we can decide what we grow. When it comes to mobility, I celebrate Copenhagen and Denmark. I was driven here on a bicycle. It's not the car, but the bicycle that is the future. It's not GMOs, but organic farming that is the future. To the corporations and their friends in some governments, we want to say your time is over. Your time is over, a new world is being born. We will build this new world. We will compel the corrupt governments to stop corrupting the world and contaminating the atmosphere. For their partnership with corporations, corporate rule has had its day. We told them in WTO, it's over. WTO hasn't got up after that. Let this be the time where you, marching to the COP15, tell the leaders, we have the power, we will change, and we will be the change we want to see, and no one is going to stop us.
That was Vandana Shiva speaking to a crowd at the Copenhagen Climate Talks in 2009. Small islands are among the most vulnerable to climate shifts. Take the Republic of Maldives, a thousand-island nation located in the Indian Ocean. Sources say rising sea levels could swallow up the nation in 100 years. Maldives President Mohamed Nasheed attended the Copenhagen talks in December 2009. He urged leaders to create a treaty based on three numbers, 350. That's 350 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Scientists and activists say that's the target number to keep the planet healthy and sustainable. Right now, we're at 387. Here, Nasheed talks about going carbon neutral and urges action on the 350 campaign.
We meet here to confront another seemingly impossible task. We are here to save our planet from the silent, patient, and invisible enemy that is climate change. And just as there were doubters in the Maldives, so there are doubters in Copenhagen. There are those who tell us that solving climate change is impossible. There are those who tell us taking radical action is too difficult. There are those who tell us to give up hope. Well, I am here to tell you that we refuse to give up hope. I am here to tell you that we refuse to be quiet. We refuse to believe that a better world isn't possible. I have three words to say to the doubters and deniers. Three words with which to win this battle. Just three words is all what we need. You may already have heard them. That is 3-5-0. 3-5-0 and 3-5-0 saves the coral reefs. 3-5-0 keeps the Arctic frozen. 3-5-0 ensures that our country survives. 3-5-0 makes a better world possible. I am here to tell you that down the road in the center, the Maldives team is fighting to keep 3-5-0 in the negotiating text. I must tell you that they need all the help that they can get from you. Please keep supporting them. And the good news is that we are now part of a growing bloc of nations, all committed to keeping 3-5-0 as the central guiding goal of global survival plan. These nations need help and support too. I'm not a scientist, but I know that one of the laws of physics is that you cannot negotiate with the laws of physics. 3-5-0 is a law of atmospheric physics. You cannot cut a deal with Mother Nature, and we don't intend to try doing that. This is why, in March, the Maldives announced plans to become the first carbon neutral country in the world. We intend to become carbon neutral in 10 years. We will switch from oil to 100% renewable energy. And we will offset aviation pollution until a way can be found to decarbonize air transport too. For us, going carbon neutral is not just the right thing to do. We believe it is in our economic self-interest. Countries that have the foresight to green their economies today will be the winners of this century. These pioneering countries will free themselves from the unpredictable price of foreign oil, and they will enhance their moral standing, giving them greater political influence on the world stage. In the Maldives, we have relinquished our claim to high carbon growth. After all, it is not carbon that we want, but development. It is not coal we want, but electricity. It is not oil we want, but transport. Low carbon technologies now exist to deliver all the goods and services we need. We believe that if the Maldives can become carbon neutral, richer, larger countries can follow. But if there is one thing I know about politicians, it's that they won't act until their electorates act first. This is where you come in. History shows us that the power of peaceful protest, from civil rights movement to Gandhi's Quit India campaign, nonviolent protest created change. Protest worked in struggle for democracy in the Maldives. And on 24th October, we saw how protest across the world put 3-5-0 firmly on Copenhagen agenda. My message to you is, continue the protest. Continue after Copenhagen. Continue despite the odds. And eventually, together, we will reach that crucial number, 3-5-0. There are scientific bottom lines that we have to respect. We know what the laws of physics say, and I think you too. The most important number in the world, the most important number you will ever hear, the most important number you'll ever say these three words. 350. 350. 350.
That was Mohamed Nasheed, President of the Republic of Maldives, speaking during the climate change talks in Copenhagen. When we talk about peoples affected by a changing climate, some argue that no one feels the effects more than indigenous people. Whether they're mountain communities suffering from melting ice caps or Alaskan natives living on crumbling territories, people who live off the land are already feeling the effects of ecological imbalances. That's according to Executive Director Tom Goldtooth of the Indigenous Environmental Network, based in northern Minnesota. He went to Copenhagen to advocate for the adoption of Indigenous rights language into the climate accord. Goldtooth spoke with Making Contact producer Pauline Bartoloni.
Basically, in a nutshell, you know, our position has been that, these technological solutions and market solutions are not real solutions. So when we have a market system such as carbon trading and carbon offset that is presented as a solution to climate change, we have to really look at what does that mean. You know, is it a mechanism that will not have will not provide assurances, you know, as far as accountability, and we're very concerned about this right now. I was just recently talking with one of our indigenous brothers from Panama, from the Kuna indigenous peoples. And they're very concerned about this initiative called Reducing Emissions from Deforestation and Degradation, or RED. It's called RED. And RED is one of the main mitigations that's being promoted by the United States and other industrialized countries. And it was one of the issues that was really being pushed in Copenhagen. There's been a 2-3 year, you know, effort by the United Nations and the World Bank and the private sector and the rich countries of the North to push this like major carbon offset initiative by using trees of the South as a tool for furthering what we call CO2 colonialism or red capitalism. This is how some of the mitigation that's being proposed is to use force as a market. Now, why this is a big issue to indigenous people? Because it raises the question of property rights. Before any system globally or locally or nationally trades any kind of commodity, there has to be a definition of who owns that commodity. In this case, who owns the trees? And deeper than that is the question, who owns the carbon? Okay? So in these areas that I'm talking about, in the global south, in the tropical regions, indigenous peoples have inhabited these regions for millennia. Indigenous peoples have been fighting not only for their indigenous rights for existence, but also their land rights and their forest rights. Okay, whether it's the Amazon forests of Brazil and Ecuador and Bolivia, or whether it's the indigenous peoples of Asia and Indonesia, Malaysia, India, Nepal, or whether it's our indigenous peoples of Africa. We're very scared that without strong mechanisms and safeguards that recognize the full rights of indigenous peoples, that these red type of initiatives, these forest carbon offsets, will end up being land grabs, the only instrument that we have on an international level that can provide a standard for the recognition of these rights is the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And ironically, civil society, governments throughout the world, a lot of the non-Indigenous peoples are now starting to look towards our Indigenous peoples for solutions. The world, our modern world, has to reevaluate what its relationship is to the sacredness of our Mother Earth. We have an industrialized model that's part of a economic globalization system that has removed people from nature, that has removed people from a sense of community. It's built upon individualism rather than communal. And many of the testimonies that we have heard from our indigenous brothers within our network is that they're calling for a change in viewpoint of how we live our lives as all human beings. So we are looking at new solutions, new economic paradigms that view the love, you could say, and the compassion for the rights of our Mother Earth and a new way of looking at humanity.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. Because of listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. We now return to Back from Copenhagen, Moving Climate Justice Forward. Many members of civil society who attended the COP15 talks were part of the climate justice movement. They work locally to create ecological solutions to climate change, which alleviate unequal burdens on marginalized communities. Victor Minotti is the director of the International Forum on Globalization. After returning from Copenhagen, he spoke on a panel in Berkeley, California, about the good and the bads of the Copenhagen Accord, and, more importantly, the road ahead.
So, the good and the bad, and a few challenges going forward. The bad was this Copenhagen Accord that came out of it, which was a hijacking of hope, as I think of it, that a good agreement was going to come out. Governments had gotten quite a long way in a very painful multilateral process of almost 200 countries trying to wrestle with the issues, and probably about 60 or 70% done of an agreement in very complex, sprawling set of negotiations. President Obama came in and facilitated by the Danish Prime Minister, who wanted, you know, to secure the legacy of Copenhagen, and President Obama, who needed something to go back and show the Senate that he was going to be able to measure and compare what China was doing to cut its carbon so that the U.S. would be able to enact its own domestic legislation. So a lot of the trade competitiveness issues were at the center of why the U.S. really went and tried to get this Copenhagen Accord. This is really an economic agreement. It's bigger than any WTO round, as far as I've seen in following that for 15 years. Because, you know, we've got to basically get the global economy off of carbon quickly. And it's going to recast global economic governance. It's going to totally redo the way our economies and our societies are oriented. So everything was at stake. Not everything was going to be agreed there, we know. But this was what they tried to extract. The real downside of it is that it flips the current structure of the convention, which is supposed to say, here's what the science says are supposed to be our cap. And then now we need a process to fairly allocate what the atmospheric space is going to be per country and per person. And that's a huge fight to figure that out. But instead, what this Copenhagen Accord does is lets every country offer or pledge what it is they're going to do, which altogether doesn't really add up nearly enough. So the government's almost agreed to a two-degree temperature rise, which kind of undercuts the countries calling for 1.5, or even Bolivia calling for just a 1 degree increase in global average temperatures. But the pledges they put on the table add up to almost 4 degrees. So it's really a suicide pact that nobody's going to be able to live with. So that's kind of the bad. This accord, we don't like it. We want to get it back on this official process. There were two main reports that came out of that official process, and that's where governments need to get back to the table, continue the very difficult work, and take the very difficult decisions. And of course, Cancun at the end of this year will be the site of COP16. A lot of groups are still right now trying to consult and figure out what is really achievable by Cancun. That's not clear to many people. The good, in my view, is that the Climate Justice Now movement was very visible and not to be ignored in Copenhagen. And you saw some really good working relationships between outside groups and inside groups, and even some governments who were taking very strong positions that were informed by a climate justice analysis of ecological debt, of climate debt. And the Climate Justice Now network was there in much bigger numbers in the official negotiations. Climate Justice Now network was formed to really bring a different equity analysis to the climate talks. And I think that's really the good news, is that it's sort of a movement that's arrived, and the politics, I think, are not going away. They're only getting sharper. So just a few challenges going forward about what we must do differently between Copenhagen and Cancun. One is to really do the difficult work of creating the constituencies in the U.S. to align what our domestic decisions are going to be on climate, whatever bill we have or whatever decision-making our government does, to align that with what's needed internationally for climate justice and for a really viable deal. Those things are right now out of whack. What you have in our domestic bills don't nearly have the emission cuts or the provisions of technology and finance as required by the convention to really bring the South, the global South, into a deal. Secondly, I think a new focus on addressing corporate power issues. I mean, it's obvious both in the congressional fight and in Copenhagen, the fossil fuels lobby is still unbreakable. And I don't think we have a plan, and there's a lot of organizing going around on coal, on oil, but I think we really need a national conversation about how we take that on, especially in light of the recent Supreme Court decision about corporate free speech. And then thirdly, I'd say is to really ground the global climate justice work in the U.S. in the grassroots community organizing that's already going on. And just to flag Detroit in June as the site of the U.S. Social Forum as a really important process and sort of stepping stone, I think, to developing that.
That was Victor Minotti, director of the International Forum on Globalization. Michelle Mascareñas-Swan is with the Movement Generation Justice and Ecology Project. Before and after the Copenhagen talks, they focused their work in urban centers, where she says folks are hit first and worst by the climate crisis. Here, she gives some examples of how city residents can gain control of managing local resources more sustainably.
Right now, the way that climate change is framed in the media and the way that people talk about it here in the United States and in cities is that climate change, climate chaos is going to affect people, is only going to really affect people who live on the land, right? There's this fallacy that urban communities won't be affected so much. And so we see it as a central task of this moment to focus on grassroots organizing in communities. We focus specifically and especially on working class communities of color in urban centers. And so we feel it's important to build sort of on three fronts. So we talk about building resistance, resilience, and reimagining. So resistance, I think, is pretty obvious. We're all talking about it. Resilience being the reality that we need to find new ways to organize ourselves and to learn how to share and to learn how to live within our ecological, you know, boundaries or limits or watershed, food sheds, things like that. And reimagining that, you know, we have been so sort of hindered by the constructs of what's forced upon us as our daily lives that it's very difficult to see the possibility of living in cooperation with one another or living in, you know, in a reflective, responsive relationship to the place that we live. So two things that we really think that folks should be doing, two strategies that folks can use on the local level to start to build these three components of building power. One is climate action plans on the local level. In Oakland, the city of Oakland is right now in the process of drafting a local climate action plan, and there's been a coalition form called the Oakland Climate Action Coalition. And we're trying to use this as an opportunity to actually advance that climate is actually about everything, right? It's about food, it's about water, it's about the way we live, it's about transportation and land use, it's about adaptation and resilience. It's about community participation. The second strategy is sort of this idea of resilient zones, we'll call them, or reclaiming the commons is something that people talk a lot about. And this is the idea that if there is vacant land, that land should be available, should just be taken, basically, by neighborhoods for gardens. And an example of this actually is right here in our backyards and in San Francisco. Power discovered that the largest landholder in the city of San Francisco is the school district. And so, which is a public entity, it's the people's land, and there are many underutilized or now closed down schoolyards. And so Power has been working to try to talk to the school district, negotiate with the school district in agreement to try to use some of these vacant schoolyards for farmers markets, for gardens, for flea markets, ways for people to generate their own grassroots economy that is rooted in human relationships and is a local economy. So I think those are a couple of examples that point to a path of how we can be investing, I think especially in local community organizing, that is going to start to open up the possibilities of what a climate justice, like a new climate justice movement that can actually build power to shift the tide and move us from a get mine to a share ours kind of infrastructure that we need.
Michelle Mascareñas-Swang is with the Movement Generation Justice and Ecology Project based in Oakland, California. That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Special thanks to KPFA radio producer Brian Edwards Tiekert. For a CD copy of this program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. Or check out our website at radioproject.org to get our podcast, download past shows, or help make a difference by supporting our work. Making Contact is supported by listeners like you. You allow us to continue to offer our programming for free to radio stations across the U.S. and in Canada and South Africa. Thank you. Lisa Redman is our executive director, Pauline Bartoloni, producer and online editor, Andrew Stelzer, producer, Con Pham, associate director, Daphne Young, station relations, Elena Daigle, Rashida Harmon, and Joaquin Palomino, our interns, and Dan Turner, Ron Rucker, Jen Gordon, Alton Bird, Emily Allen, Alfonso Hooker, volunteers. And I'm Tina Rubio. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.